Welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell in the chair with you this morning for the next hour here on RN. Great to have you with us. Coming up, I tweet, therefore I am. Writer and cultural commentator Clem Bastow has been doing some hard thinking about whether our online selves can ever really be genuinely authentic. She's joining us to consider that very question. And in our Everyday Economics segment, Jessica Irvine joins us today. We're talking housing affordability. We know it's dire in Australia. Are foreign investors in Australian residential property driving prices up? Is that part of the story here? We'll be looking more closely at that too. Join us on Facebook, as many of you are, and we're on Twitter at RN Life Matters. It's a story that continues to baffle and perplex people, doesn't it? The missing Malaysian airline flight MH370. It disappeared off the radar screens and seemingly vanished in thin air over 10 days ago now. 239 people on board. Was it an explosion, a hijacking, a terror attack? As the search continues, all this is only conjecture. And while many of us watch on with intrigue and feel a little nervous, perhaps, about boarding our next flight, what is it like for the families of passengers as they oscillate between hope and despair, between loss and possibility? Certainly, it must be a horrendous state of limbo to be in, and this all takes my next guest back to an event in her life that changed her life in 1981. And it left her very much in a similar state of limbo. Yvonne Pembroke's husband disappeared in a flight from Queensland to Sydney. The plane was never found, and she joins us this morning. Welcome, Yvonne.
Good morning.
And good on you for joining us. No mean feat. Sarah Wayland is with us too. She's a grief counsellor and researcher specialising in the area of missing persons. We've heard about some of her PhD studies before on the program. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thank you.
Before I come to you, Yvonne, Sarah, let's connect with the current situation briefly. With all the uncertainty and the tsunami of media coverage, I mean, this really defines this situation. How might families be feeling at the moment, families of those on board? I mean, where does hope fit into the spectrum of what they're feeling, do you think?
Look, it's interesting. When we look at all of the narratives that are shared within the media and in such real time, when we look at disasters like this, we notice that the narratives often include the word hope, yet we don't technically understand what hope means all of the time. It's an emotion that we attach to the experience of not knowing what's going to happen next. But as this continues, as the days continue to pass without us knowing, those ideas of hope might begin to change for families as they wait for news of what might have happened to their loved ones.
How might they change?
What I've noticed, my PhD focuses on the experience of hope and the space between hopefulness and hopelessness for families of missing people. And what we've noticed both in my research and in looking at the literature is that these ideas of hope begin to be revised over time. So in those early few days, people are looking for their lives to return as they used to be before. So for the person to return and for their lives to continue on. And then what happens with these sorts of scenarios when there's all of this, you know, huge amounts of news that come out and the hypotheses that are shared, then there's some ideas of hope about wanting to find some answers. And so people continue to revise these over time. And in a long-term case, it's about people just wanting to either find information out or to learn to live with the loss long-term.
And that's the key, isn't it? Because those answers may never, ever come. Yvonne, the answers never came for you, did they? And I wonder how you've been feeling this week.
Well, of course, every time I hear, you know, plane missing, you know, my heart skips a beat and I do go back to that space. But I was just listening to what Sarah said and it really identified with how I was feeling quite often during the whole period, even up until now, wanting to know what happened, but yet at the same time, I don't. I don't want the upheaval.
That's interesting, isn't it? Even now, if you found out more detail about what happened to your husband and those other men on that single-engine Cessna, even now, that
even
would...
now, yeah. Mm. Well, they had a fairly large search last year, and that brings it all up again. It's just you know, there isn't any finality to it.
Mm. Tell us what happened 32 years ago. I mean, your husband, Philip Pembroke, was on that single-engine Cessna. There were five on board, I think.
There were four men,
four men.
The pilot.
And the pilot.
And the pilot, yeah. Yeah, they were flying back from Proserpine. They made a stop in Coolangatta to refuel, and they were told that the weather was bad ahead, but they still, well, the pilot made a decision to go on, and they hit bad weather and had a few problems, and unfortunately was over the worst terrain in the country, Barrington Tops, and now they believe that it has fallen down a very steep gorge, which is, you know, which is impenetrable. It's never going to be found by a bushwalker walking along. It's in a place that's that where no man has been.
And no amount of searching has come up with any clues. It really remains our only unsolved civil aviation accident in terms of a crash on the mainland, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yvonne, in those days and weeks and months at the time of the accident, particularly the days afterwards, what was going through your mind that might connect with those, with the Malaysian Airlines flight?
Well, initially, you know, when I heard the news, I just thought death. I thought plane in the air, goes down, death. So that was my initial shock. I went into shock. And then, of course, the next day they said, oh, we're searching. And you know, before long there are so many theories of that they might have landed in a paddock or they might have gone here or there. And then, that's when the hope or whatever that you want to call it is mixed in with the despair. I was in despair all the time, but then there would be occasional glimmers of hope where I'd hang on to anything that I thought where there was a possibility that he would be found alive. I hung on to it. Even clairvoyance came into it, and they said two men are still alive.
Oh,
so I thought, oh, mine's got to be one of those. And they said, but they will only be alive for another, 48 hours. So, of course, when the 48 hours is up, then there's back to despair again. It's just up and down the whole time, but mostly down.
And I wondered to what extent you found yourself rehearsing scenarios as time moved on. Did those scenarios still stay with you? I know that he was in your dreams a lot.
Yes, I did. In the first couple of years, I dreamed a lot that he was back, and this whole thing was a nightmare. And I think that's common when people do die. I dreamt that he was back, and I was so happy in the dream, and then I woke up and I'd be disappointed. And so what I started to do was dream, and in the dream, I had woken up and he was really back. So, oh God, I was so happy then because he was really back, and the whole thing was a nightmare. And I think this went on for maybe up to 2 years.
And in those 2 years, you had your son, because you were 7 months pregnant and age 30 when he went missing.
No, that was 7 weeks pregnant.
7 weeks pregnant.
Yes.
So just knew.
I just knew, and he just knew as well.
I wonder if that played into this need to be ever more hopeful because you knew you had the baby coming.
Oh, definitely, because I thought he can't leave without being the father of my child. He's got to come back. So, I started to fantasize, and I think that might be a common thing to do when there's no proof, fantasize. And I started looking in crowds, a lot of people, or maybe he's in there, and then the roads changed on the way back to my place, and I thought, oh, he won't know his way back. I started to be delusional, even though, I thought I was a logical person.
Yeah.
I just started to fantasize of all these different scenarios that could possibly have happened and that he would return.
Was there a time when the scenarios stopped?
I wouldn't say it was a definite time. I think it just faded and faded. And then it comes acceptance. And look, at the time, 1981, counselling wasn't offered. It wasn't common to have counselling. It was only people with, mental disorders that had counselling. So I didn't have counselling for the first 5 years. And when I started having counselling, I came to accept the situation.
Mm. When did you start to have counselling?
That was 5 years after the event.
Right. Sarah Wayland, I mean, you're listening to Yvonne and I can hear you in the background.
It's very difficult for me to not go.
Because this sort of cycle is very much at the heart of what you work with, both as a counsellor but also a researcher, isn't it? The ambiguity of the grief, of the loss.
That's right. That's right. Back in 2006, I was awarded a Churchill Fellowship. So I travelled from Australia, pregnant at the time myself, over to the US to meet with Emeritus Professor Pauline Boss, who's the pioneer of ambiguous loss. And I spent a week with her just talking through what I had noticed from the families who shared their stories here with me and how we could put some ideas together about talking to other counsellors about responding to ambiguity. Because I think what is underneath all of these threads of conversations is that in our community we don't cope very well with not knowing.
And therapists certainly don't cope with the ambiguity of that sort of loss either, do they?
We don't. And I can remember very clearly, I was actually just finishing my methodology chapter this week for my PhD and reflecting on those early days when I started working in missing persons, and there was nothing to guide me about how I should be engaging with these families, because we just didn't know what the right thing to do was. And it's very difficult in a counselling space to sit and listen to people who are searching for answers and not be able to give them something back. And so that learning of how to tolerate ambiguity actually came to me from asking the families questions about what did they do to learn to sit with the not knowing, rather than always jumping ahead and thinking, have you tried this? Have you searched there? Have you accepted it on this level? What do you need for closure? Just sitting with where it was at that point in time.
So how do you work therapeutically with this idea of ambiguous grief? How is this very idea, this very naming of the sort of experience that Yvonne had to grapple with over many years now, how does that become then a therapeutic tool?
Look, the process behind working therapeutically with families is very much similar to grief work, about normalising those grief reactions, but naming them as being different than the experience of bereavement. And that is usually the first way to be able to release people from these ideas of how they should be behaving when something like this happens. It's very normal for people to feel, and like Yvonne said, about these periods of ups and downs, of hope and despair, of that being a very normal path to travel when someone is missing.
And perhaps people also expecting you at some point to let go.
Exactly.
And even that's not necessarily possible.
It's not possible. And those customary markers of grief, you know, those things that we're allowed to do in the community when someone passes away, like put a funeral notice in the paper or go to a funeral or any of those things, families of missing people are excluded from that process. And that works in two ways. Either that they're not able to acknowledge openly that they think this person isn't coming back, or not wanting to do that because they're not yet at the point where they think that this person isn't coming back.
Sarah Wayland is with me this morning. She's a grief counsellor specialising in missing persons. And Yvonne Pembroke is with us too. Her husband, Philip, died, we think, in a plane crash over 20 years ago now, over Barrington Tops in New South Wales. But that was never confirmed. And that's very much what we're discussing about in the context of the Malaysian airline that's missing now. Yvonne, I imagine you're hearing Sarah and thinking, gosh, wouldn't have been good to have that sort of therapeutic kind of embrace at the time.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking, because there was nothing offered. You know, there were reporters, police, everybody, but the help I needed. Mm. And I didn't even know it was there.
And just thinking about Sarah's reflection on not being able to bury your loved one's body, not being able to ceremonially farewell them intact, where did that leave you?
Well, that left me that what happened was a number of different groups put on memorial services. So there were about three or four memorial services, none of which I had prepared. So I didn't, you know, they became meaningless because there were so many. If there was just one, and maybe if I had just done that myself, there may have been a little bit of closure, but it was just all out of my control. Other people were doing it, and it was, you know, work-related, different parts of the family, friends, and, yeah, so that left me, you know, and then, of course, discarding of his belongings, you know, all of that, you know, what do you do with them? They just stayed in the cupboard, and sometimes I'd open the wrong part of the wardrobe and get a fright.
Yeah. But also for you, I think, starting new relationships always left you with that lingering sense that he might come back, so you can't get too serious.
Well, I did, because I always wanted the father of, to be with the father of my son. I think that if there wasn't a child, I might have been able to, you know, move on to that a lot quicker and just be a bit more logical about it, because there was so much going on. I didn't really put much of an effort into starting another relationship, and if I did, it was either, it wasn't committed.
How did your relationship to Philip, in your mind, change over time?
That's really interesting. Over time of his disappearance, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Well,
because I guess our loved ones live on large in our minds, don't they, when they're dead or missing?
Well, yeah, that is an interesting question. Mm. That is nobody has really asked me that question before, but what actually, we were very close to start with, but as it developed, right now, I know him a lot better, and I'm a lot closer to him than when he was around, because, you know, during the child raising, I would, you know, talk about how the father would have done this, and then I see the child doing things the father would do, so, and then also learning about his family, parents, you know, a little bit more. I really became closer to him in death.
Isn't that incredible?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, gosh. Sarah Wayland, with the people that you work with, how do you observe how their relationship changes to the missing person in their psyche, in their mind?
It's really interesting, because for a long time I felt like I was always missing a part of the puzzle when I would sit with people and talk to them about the person that wasn't here, because we talk a lot without being able to compare and contrast, because the missing person isn't in that space. But what's interesting, and what Yvonne just said, and I think your words were absolutely beautiful, Yvonne, and so I was quickly writing them down as you were saying them, that this idea that we begin to engage with people about understanding who they are as people when they're no longer here is really powerful. And we make the mistake so often in our community when we talk about missing people that we only focus on their missingness, that we don't give families an opportunity to talk about the person for who they were, for what they stood for what their values were, because we get so caught up on being the pseudo-detectives out there in the community about trying to solve these disappearances that we forget that there's a person at the very core of these conversations.
Yes.
And so giving power back to sometimes not just saying, tell us about the missing person, sometimes just saying, tell us about the person, is the most open and engaging conversation that you can offer to someone left behind.
Yvonne, I wonder how you reflect on that.
Yeah, look, I just want to have a conversation with Sarah.
I think we'll be putting you in touch with each other after this. That's all right.
I'll make a big pot of tea and we can have a chat.
That's terrific.
It's opened up another line of, you know, where I was with him in his absence.
Yes.
Mm.
Both of you, just finally, for those who might be listening, who because of course there were Australians on board that plane, is there anything you'd like to say to them?
I think, you know, I think what's important is that whatever you're feeling at any point in time is a valid emotion to have. And sometimes those ideas about engaging with what's happening in the media is useful for some families, and for others, pulling back and kind of turning inwards is the only way to survive. So whatever path people find to be able to get up each day and keep moving forwards, that's the right way to be behaving when this happens. Because we don't have any ideas that this will happen in our lifetime. It's not a normal grief experience to have. So we don't have anything to draw upon about how we should be behaving.
Yvonne, your thoughts?
Mm.
hard as they may be.
Yeah, look, I'm agreeing with Sarah because, look, I'm not qualified. I can only say, you know, from my experience and how I'd imagine, you know, everyone is different in the way they feel and the way they behave. Some people are very logical and some are, you know, and depending on how, what relationship they have with the one that's disappeared.
Look, we're going to put you in touch at the end of this conversation, if that's okay.
Okay.
It sounds like we need to.
Sounds good.
Yvonne Pembroke, thank you very much for joining us. This is a tough conversation to have and a valuable one, I think, with your experience lending a hand to others. Thank you.
Oh, that's my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. And grief counsellor Sarah Wayland, thank you for joining us again.
Not a problem. Thanks, Natasha.
And look, if a conversation like this raises some difficult feelings for you, Lifeline is a good place to start. 13 11 14, that's 1311 14. And we'll pop more information on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. Look for Life Matters. And for this story, gee, what a conversation. Natasha Mitchell with you right here on RN, Life Matters. Jessica Irvine swinging by shortly for our Everyday Economics segment.
Do you love music? Then you'll love The Inside Sleeve on RN. Hi, my name's Dom Alessio, and throughout March, I'll be taking time off from Triple J to be your guide to the world of new music. Whatever your taste, I reckon there'll be something for you. Think of it as an eclectic mixtape delivered straight to you every weekday afternoon from 3. That's The Inside Sleeve with me, Dom Alessio, right here on RN.
And so to our Everyday Economics segment, I think we can all agree there's a housing affordability crisis in Australia. Is there any truth, though, to headlines that foreign investors buying up properties are driving up house prices? Chinese investors have taken a particular shine to the Australian housing market of late, according to all the headlines. And as we heard on RN Breakfast on Monday, Federal Parliament's House Economics Committee will re-examine the laws governing foreign investment. One of the questions they'll be asking is whether it's having a distorting impact on our residential real estate market, and we need that like a hole in the head, don't we? Jessica Irvine is joining us this morning for our Everyday Economics segment. She's, of course, the economics editor at News Limited. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good to have you in the Life Matters studio.
Very good to be here.
I mean, economics is your professional turf, but this has a private dimension to it too, because you've written about this and your own quest as a renter to try and get into the market.
I have disclosed this. I put disclosures on all my columns that I am a renter. I'm 32 years old and I have not joined the great Australian dream yet of home ownership, but I'm actually okay with that. I've accepted the reality that housing is incredibly expensive in Australia and it is just taking us longer to accumulate that deposit. Mm-hmm. But when you see the reports that house prices are going up 10% a year nationally and you're trying to save and you can't quite even keep up with the rising house prices, that is very disconcerting to a lot of people. So that is sort of the base underlying trend under which we now see this red real estate peril that is being reported in the newspapers, and a lot of concern that there is an increase in demand from overseas investors, not just Chinese investors.
And that's key, because there has been a yellow peril kind of element to the discussion. Actually, who is investing in our property?
Yes, well, the Foreign Investment Review Board recently put out its annual report, so we can see exactly where the money's coming from. And Chinese buyers are the number one group. So by dollar value, they've purchased about $6 billion worth of Australian properties last financial year. But not very far behind that, with $5 billion worth, were the Americans. Mm. Or the Canadians, it's the Canadians or the Americans, are both equal pegging at about $4 or $5 billion a year.
They're the three major investors. Our property is attractive to them.
It is very attractive. I mean, we sometimes forget this, but we've got very attractive property located in beautiful cities with fantastic
beautiful blue
views,
sky over the
river
top.
Views. Yeah. Australia is a very attractive place for people to live and also to invest, because although we worry about changing taxes on the mining tax and the carbon tax, we do a bit of hand-wringing about whether that creates a threat to the investor confidence. Actually, we're a stable democracy. We have a good standard of living. Governments don't change, well, they do change sometimes quite often, but we're fairly a stable place.
It's amazing how we talk ourselves down so much, isn't it, given our how lucky we are.
But
there have been a range of figures bandied about, Jessica. So the Credit Suisse report last week that got a lot of publicity said that 14% of properties in Melbourne and 18% in Sydney, of these are new properties,
yep,
are being bought up by Chinese investors. Is that accurate? Because then you read other figures that suggest that it's only 2%.
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of 2-3% of total property turnover, which includes established homes and new homes. So that is a less scary figure. But we have tried to divert foreign investors into new properties. So that is where they are more predominant. And it's true that they are more interested in city apartments,
which a lot of first home buyers are wanting to purchase
as well,
too, because that traditionally has been where they want to live and they're affordable, perhaps.
Yep, and all property is local.
They're not so affordable, mind you.
Well, they're not particularly affordable, and they're getting less so. But so all property is local, and so we have seen quite a very narrow range of interest even from foreign buyers. It is in the cities, it's in inner city areas, and it seems to be predominantly apartments, and also apartments that are very well located to universities and schools. There actually does seem to be a bit of a trend, and Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens observed this recently as what he had seen as well, that it is sometimes the parents of wealthier families in China or Asia who are sending their children here to take
Do study. And they buy up property on the way.
And they buy up property nearby. And the question really for affordability is, are they just sitting on those properties? Are they using that as a holiday house for when they come to visit? Or is that actually meaning that an apartment is coming into the world that wouldn't otherwise have been there, and they're letting that out to somebody else? Because that would actually reduce the pressure on affordability, particularly in the rental market, if we've got new investors buying apartments, letting them out.
Because one of the key issues in terms of affordability is that there just aren't enough properties available, is the
exactly
argument, and that's what's driving prices up. But people have described Chinese buyers as marginal purchasers, I think, and that is they're prepared to pay more than most people would in terms of the domestic market, and that drives prices up. Is that a genuine phenomenon?
I think that is a genuine phenomenon. When you look at investing, where to invest your money as a Chinese national in China, you aren't dealing with that same stable regime that we are here. There are tax changes, interest rates change. You don't necessarily know where your money will be safe. So there is a premium that Chinese buyers in particular are willing to pay to just have that certainty that if I buy this property, it will retain its value and you know, will increase in value as well. But I know that that money is safe. It's safe than under my bed at home.
Is that something to be concerned about then? If this is a genuine possibility that these investors are driving prices up, how concerned should we be about that?
Well, it's a matter of degree, you know, so we need to keep in context those, whether it is only 2-3% of turnover. If house prices went up 10% last year, that's not entirely because of foreign buyers, but it might add sort of a percentage or two. So it is something, you know, Glenn Stevens observed that all foreign investment does contribute to price pressure. So it's definitely there. Whether it is the predominant factor in house prices going up, I don't think so. I think we've just struggled for a really long time to have the urban planning and the land release and the infrastructure that can support the housing need that we already have. So I think that's really the main the main issue is just we do not build enough homes.
Yeah, it's the perfect storm, isn't it?
And to the extent that Chinese investment or foreign investment would actually lead to new apartments being built, that would be good for us. But we're not sure in on the ground level whether that is actually happening.
That's certainly been the claim. Yesterday the press reported that China Business Council President Duncan Calder claiming that in fact Chinese buyers had boosted supply rather than driven up prices. We just don't know which it is.
Exactly. And the thing about building apartments is it takes a lot longer and it is a lot more expensive than building a house. You can build a freestanding house in less than a year, get that away, but these big apartment projects take about 6 years in development, and there's lots of associated costs for, you know, building services to those apartments.
Now, what's the role, just before we get to an idea that you've got,
yes.
What's the role of the Foreign Investment Review Board in this whole issue? Have they got any role in curtailing, dovetailing, directing investment in a very particular way, for example, away from established properties and into new properties? Do they have any kind of control over whether or not those houses stand kind of empty, or whether they actually are incorporated into the rental market?
Not currently. I mean, FIRB is the government agency that you apply as a foreign investor to, and they apply a set of rules which are given to them by government. So it used to be a foreign investor could buy any property in Australia. In recent years, we narrowed that down. The Rudd and Gillard governments narrowed that down only to new properties. So that is actually for the government to decide. And one of the things that could be interesting is if they made a policy that said, well, you can buy a house, but you must also prove to us that you're not living in it and that you're letting it out. Could be one thing that you could do.
Because that's been a huge concern, that these properties are just being bought up as an investment but not actually making it to the market to benefit all of those who live here.
Exactly. I mean, that starts to become, you know, a bit complex to administer, and whether FIRB has that capacity at the moment, that's something that the Parliamentary Review should be looking at, to see whether FIRB can be a little bit more than just a rubber stamp, essentially.
So noted economist Saul Eslake, of course, last year gave a presentation and offered, this really pisses him off, this whole issue. And we really haven't got our act together over 50 years on housing affordability, and there are all sorts of levers we could pull to do that, starting with ditching first home owner grants for him and negative gearing, of course, that came under his spotlight, and a whole range of things, including improving the tax breaks, etc., and making it a whole lot easier for people to invest in new developments. But you've got an idea in response to the foreign investors.
Yeah, and it sort of tic-tacs off Saul's work as well, because one of the main thing that adds to the cost of new properties coming onto the market is these infrastructure charges and development levies that state governments do impose on developers, and they impose on the buyers. They pass that cost on of building sort of local community infrastructure, whether it's better public transport, it's more schools that are needed, it's another library, it's a park. The governments, you know, are planning for those things, and that's good, but the cost is borne by buyers, because state governments don't tend to have a lot of money, so, and nor do many governments around Australia. So my idea is, if you have a lot of money coming into the country and people are very willing to pay this premium for the stability of buying in Australia, why not apply a differential rate of stamp duty or increase the tax that people would pay when they purchase a property in Australia as a foreigner? So you could very easily have a different rate of stamp duty. And if you sort of added that onto the cost of each property, if you've got 11,000 foreign purchases a year, you could very easily get into something I've calculated on the back of an envelope, like $1 billion a year. And if state governments were able
to... That's a great back of the envelope calculation.
I love those.
Oh, random $1 billion on the back of an envelope. But the key is that money could be used.
That money could
to
be
invest
used
in infrastructure.
To relieve those charges on first-time buyers. So you could actually, instead of sort of stopping it altogether, and I wouldn't want to see foreign investment stopped altogether, but to actually charge a price for admission at the door, essentially, to say, if you're willing to to buy here if you want the stability, pay a bit more tax, and if we use that money to relieve some of the pressure on young buyers buying a first home, that's a win-win.
Well, as long as it goes into focused and differentiated revenue streams rather than general revenue, because you'd want this money to actually go back into alleviating the housing affordability issue. I mean, some people say, so it's interesting to hear you say just briefly, no, you don't want to stop foreign investment in residential properties. That's because you obviously see a benefit.
Well, I think that we need to be a nation.
Stop it.
We need to be a nation that embraces foreign investment, and we do, and it drives a lot of our investment that we do locally. So I don't think it's a good look to be turning people away at the door. And other countries don't, but other countries like Hong Kong and like Singapore do apply a tax. So it's a way of sort of saying you're welcome but at a price, which I think is a nice halfway house.
It's interesting that we don't apply a tax at the moment. Hey, Jessica, really great to have you for your first starring in our Everyday Economics segment, familiar to ABC audiences, but it's great to have you in the Lifeguard
studio. Good to be here, lovely.
Thank you. And of course, you will have something to say about this. Get on our Facebook page. There's a post there for you to comment on. Foreign investment and housing affordability in Australia, a live issue. And Everyday Economics at this time, every week on a Wednesday. Well, up next, how real is a life lived online?
What did the great philosopher Frank Sinatra say about New York? If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. But from the heart of the city, one man's preaching an end to the secular religion of success. Tim Keller, a megachurch leader from an unlikely place, the Upper West Side. As New York Magazine put it, he's out to save the yuppie souls of Wall Street. This week on the Religion and Ethics Report, this afternoon at 5:30.
Well, there's your phone. Go on, pick it up. You know you want to. There's a Facebook feed to check, a Twitter stream to tap into, tweets to retweet, Facebook posts to like. There's a whole parallel universe going on right now. Another universe in which to validate yourself or at least distract you from this one. That might not be you at all. You might not have caught the social media bug or just use Facebook really to connect with your family. But if it is the very urge you have right now, you might find yourself wondering at some stage, as my next guest has been, how much of a life lived online can be really an authentic life? You know, blood and flesh authentic. Is it truly you doing the tweeting, or just the you you want to project? Who are you anyway? Melbourne-based writer Clem Bastow penned a great article in the Saturday paper recently, headed up as I Tweet, Therefore I Am, and she joins me. Welcome back to Life Matters, Clem.
Thanks for having me.
This article is music to my ears.
I'm glad.
Because it's something that plagues my consciousness as well. What really prompted it for you?
Look, I've been online kind of on and off since about, 1998, I guess. So I've sort of seen a lot of it social media-wise come and go. And I've been at times incredibly prolific online and then really pulled back. And I've kind of been dipping my toe back in the water this year. I had 2 years off Facebook and about a year off Twitter. And so coming back at it with kind of fresh eyes has been really interesting to compare how I interact with it now based on what I once did, which was to be constantly online and have about 10 tabs open, each one having a different social media platform in it.
Yeah, I mean, we need to really give people a sense. If they weren't familiar with your online identity, you were a frenetic, viscerally open Twitter user and blogger. Your life was there for all of us to see. It was incredibly powerful.
Yeah, warts and all, I think, is the phrase most often used.
Did it have an impact on you?
It did. I mean, because you kind of get to a point where, you know, you're experiencing something and you don't even think, should I put this online? It's just a natural thing that happens. I mean, you see it when you're out at restaurants, you see people taking photos of their food. It's that kind of thing. It just becomes this second nature, and that in itself is quite alarming. And when you do that, you know, I mean, the thing about social media is it is an interactive platform. So even if you're just talking about what's in the news, people have that instant access to you. So when I think, I think when you're sharing your life online and kind of living this virtual reality thing, that instant access that people have to you can become a lot more personal.
I wonder how it affects too the way we, because this is what I've been thinking about, how does it affect the way we live in the physical world? And you see it. You see people kind of hunched over their phone. You know, I'm one of them. Kind of, there's a whole world going on around us, but somehow we've been, you know, captured by this little screen.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I think there is a tendency to romanticise this notion of the past, that, oh, once upon a time, you know, we interacted with the world in a lot more of an authentic way. But, you know, 50 years ago, perhaps people would have said the same thing about Kodak Instamatic cameras. You know, I'm so sick of seeing people taking Kodak happy snaps all the time. So I think it is important to remember that people are still interacting with the world. I mean, would we rather that people didn't go out to restaurants or see live music at all and just exist in a bubble in their own living rooms? Or are we having to kind of adjust our idea of what it is to exist in the world?
Yeah, I mean, some would argue that the discourse we have online is as real and as authentic as any conversation we have anywhere, whether it's virtual or verbal. You though, you are wondering about whether or not those interactions are authentic, and it was, and certainly you mentioned the death of Charlotte Dawson as a prompt, that here was a very public death, and how it was played out in social media somehow felt gratuitous to you, I sense.
Yeah, I think what's important to remember is that grief is a real response, and so when you talk about things like this, I think it's important not to police how people experience grief. You know, you can't predict how something like that will affect you. However, I think what happens on social media often is that there is a real disconnect from the kind of the real unanswerable questions, and instead you have these strange situations happening where, for example, there were people using her death as a kind of jumping off point for content creation or to sell tickets to shows that were sort of tangentially related to something that they thought might have had to do with her death.
Yeah, it's a bit gross.
And I think that, you know, that is one of the great things about the internet, is that we're sort of free to express ourselves and experience the world. But I think that the flip side to that is that people do often forget that there are real people on the other side of the computer. You know, would you necessarily do that in real life? If you were hanging around with people who were grieving a person, would you say, hey, listen, guys, I've got this show on, or sound off about what you thought was the cause? I mean, it's happening again this week. You know, Mick Jagger's partner, Lorraine Scott, has died. And, man, I didn't know there were so many budding Daily Mail journalists out there, but, gee, everybody's got an opinion about it.
Yeah.
You'd think that they were all close personal friends with him, the way they sound off.
And the fact that, you know, she's not an accomplished fashion designer in her own right rather than just Mick Jagger's girlfriend. But that,
yes, well, that's a classic.
Not to discount the impact on him. So now that you're back in the online sphere, in a fairly prolific way but more moderated, what does it mean for you to be authentic online?
Well, I suppose the thing is, and the point of that article was to question the notion of authenticity online. I mean, the thing is, a phrase I once heard used, which I really grabbed onto with both hands, is the theatre of the internet. You know, the process of writing even just a tweet or a Facebook status, you're still having to consider that. You know, there's still a process of not drafting necessarily, although Facebook apparently is very interested in that. They have codes that are aware when you self-censor on Facebook.
So say you
write a status and you go, oh, maybe not. There's little gremlins in their computers that are actually aware that's happening.
Watching those words as they appear and get deleted in real time.
Yeah, so right. They're, I think, quite interested in using that to work out how to encourage you perhaps not to be so self-censoring. But I think, you know, this idea that I think people who are perhaps more recent converts to social media think that, I don't know, that they're just being themselves, that it's all authentic. You know, I experience all my emotions online. I'm very out there. You know, people who talk about something making them cry or making them angry or making them happy. And I think It's all how authentic can it be?
There's an element of performance. I mean, but life is a performance, isn't it, Clem? I mean,
absolutely.
Every conversation we have,
yes. Is there really true consciousness?
now we've really entered the matrix.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. I think, you know, if say you had a social media, which I'm sure will eventually happen, where say someone had a head camera that was recording them 24 hours a day, then you could say that was truly unfiltered and authentic. But would that not then lead to a form of performance because you knew that people were watching? This is the question.
Yeah.
I mean, you get really kind of matrix stoner with this stuff, but I think it's just important to remember, that it is kind of constructed version of yourself. And so this is the thing. I mean, even when I was very unfiltered and out there, and I think I still am to a certain extent, people often didn't think, you know, to consider how much I was holding back. So what I put online looks like 100% of what I'm going through.
Well, and it was raw. It was often very, very raw. You were, you know, talking about relationship breakups and talking about despair and talking about depression. I mean, it was all there. I mean, powerfully so, actually.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about that stuff. No, you know, I mean, it is still a kind of, there's a process of deciding what to talk about. But I do think, if anything, the depression stuff and the kind of sorrow and despair, that I think was worthwhile because I think more often than not, I'm sure there were people out there who thought, oh, my God, what a loser. But, you know, once or twice a week I'll get a message from somebody saying, you know, thanks so much for being open about this. It makes me feel like I'm not alone, or it makes me feel okay that I don't feel great all the time. And, you know, we still really struggle with talking about things like mental illness. There is a real stigma there. And I think that that's something that social media has really been a fantastic boon for.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
These support communities and people are able to discuss these things in a way that they might not feel comfortable discussing in real life.
Yeah, I mean, that's authentic, you know.
Yes.
That's authentic when we can cleave open those aspects of ourselves and share them for the benefit of others. One of the things that I often think about is the fact that people just struggle to sit in the company of themselves these days, and they're instant. It's like a Pavlovian response, like a rat at a lever. We reach for our phone quick. There's a whole stream there to kind of get in on. And I just wonder what that's done to our imaginative selves, you know. And that is an authentic aspect of ourselves, that capacity to daydream, to just let loose in our own state of being, you know.
It's interesting. I took up lap swimming in a very desultory fashion. I wasn't going very fast, but I found that a really powerful way to kind of reconnect with that daydreaming, basically. So I was sort of just going slowly up and down the lanes with my flippers on, and I would really just do a lot of thinking underwater because you can't. Well, you can take a phone. I have seen waterproof phone cases.
Don't tell me
but
that.
But it's true. You know, I mean, I think I struggle with that, and I'm a long-term, you know, committed single diner and moviegoer and the like, and it is tough. You know, it's hard to just put that phone down and sit there. Because we don't really talk to each other in real life, which is fine. I don't think that's necessarily a sign that humanity is doomed. But that temptation is always there. There's a fantastic scene in Young Adult, the film that Diablo Cody wrote, where Mavis Gary, the character played by Charlize Theron, she's sitting in a bar waiting for this high school sweetheart, and she just picks up her phone and just types, you know. And, I mean, we've all done it. You know, you're waiting for a date or waiting to meet your friends, and you just kind of pick out your phone and punch away at it so that you look unapproachable, I guess.
I recently deleted the Facebook app off my phone. Now I've got to log on, and it's really good. It's quite liberating.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah. I did the same. I took it out of my bookmarks bar. So having to just that action of having to type in a URL just is that slight stumbling block.
It's excellent. Know. It's liberating.
Sometimes all that you need.
So the thing is, you have taken this whole engagement to another level because people may not know this. You're doing this whole 1970s project.
Yes.
This is the performative aspect of this, the whole thing.
The great irony of this was I'm doing this thing this year primarily to try and save money and disconnect from capitalism, where I'm living in the 70s in inverted commas, so I'm, you know, doing a lot of op shopping and cooking a lot of Margaret Fulton food. But the great irony of all that is that I've had to record it via social media. So it becomes this if a tree falls in the woods thing that I'm very conscious of, where if I haven't written a blog post, which I haven't for about a month, I automatically think, are people assuming I've failed? You know, do they think the project is over if I'm not documenting it?
Do you feel that? Do you feel that if you're not documenting it's not real, not happening?
I have felt that. I mean, it's interesting. I have a friend who works in the department at UCLA where they actually invented a major part of the internet. And he sent me this great list of, you know, rebuttals to people saying, why are you still on the internet? Most of the things that we use today were around in their infancy in the 70s. So in that sense, I'm not breaking the rules by being online. But it's very strange. You know, I sort of thought, I'll have announced this project. If I just do it, are people going to think that it hasn't worked if they can't see it happening? So I've been really enjoying Twitter and Instagram because you can just fire them off. It's like, here's my terrible white bread sandwich. You know, look, here's my shag pot carpet. They can see I'm still living it.
Here's my macrame project.
Absolutely.
Brown and orange.
So much brown and orange. But the thing is, more kind of anything deeper than that, I've been really resisting because the irony of it all is the project is going so well and I'm being such a 70s person that I'm spending a lot of time with friends and reading and listening to records and not being in the house where once upon a time I would have been just hanging out, say, on Facebook or Tumblr.
That is superb. We'll link to your blog that's illustrating this whole project. It's fantastic, Clem. Fantastic article, real
Thank
food
you.
For thought.
And did you read it online or did you read it in actual paper? That's the question.
Both.
Oh, well done.
Old-fashioned and new-fashioned all at once.
That's the way to be.
Yeah, I tweet, therefore I am. Clem, thanks for joining us on Life Matters.
Thanks so much.
Clem Bastow. And we'll link to her Tumblr site, Clem Bistro, actually, 2070.com.au, but we'll link to that on our Facebook page and on our website. And you'll have some thoughts on this. And she's going to participate in an event too on narcissism and selfies as well, in the spirit of this conversation. Well, on Life Matters, I just want to squeeze in a fantastic letter that we got in response to Alan Powers, who joined us recently. He's a geriatrician, and he wants us to really rethink how we think about dementia and aged care, changing those physical spaces, but also reconceptualising what it means to have cognitive loss. And we got this letter from Helen. My dad had dementia. We both knew he had it for years. He had his licence taken from him, but adjusted to the gopher and lived, with support, in a self-care unit. He very strongly expressed a wish not to go to hospital, but to die quietly at home from his dicky ticker. I was fine with that and told him to ring me any time and I would be with him. Unfortunately, one of his house cleaning people decided he had to go to hospital one day and didn't tell me until he had been shipped off in an ambulance. Once in hospital, the powers that be, and they do this all the time, refused to let him go back to his unit, and so he was admitted to the nursing home part of the organisation. Until then, taking his car from him was the hardest thing I'd done. Now I had to tell him he wasn't allowed to go home. While the care he got was good, it could have been so much better. He hated being showered and was still fanatical about cleanliness. I asked him if they could let him shower on his own, but to fulfil their obligations about falls, etc., they kept the door open while they made his bed and just sit on the bed while he finished off. I haven't quite read that right. And I know it was all about time. The staff didn't have enough to allow him this luxury. One night, Dad got up and made a cup of tea because that is what he has always done when he woke during the night. He also was used to falling asleep in his chair while watching telly. This tea making caused huge problems. Instead of letting him finish off, they ordered him back to bed, something he couldn't understand. They tried to make him go back to bed. He objected. All this was happening while he had the freshly boiled kettle in his hands. He ended up splashing hot water at their feet, so they called the police. One admission, I'd told them that if ever Dad had any upsets, just to get him on the phone at any time of the day or night, and I would be able to talk him round. Sadly, they couldn't do this, and so problems became monumental. Fortunately, Dad only lived a month in this place and was blessedly released from the constraints, which were so hard for him to adjust to after 80-plus years of self-reliance. Thank you very much, Helen, for that, and it's a story I relate to. From my grandmother's experience of going into a nursing home. Well, that's nearly the end of the show. Books and Arts Daily is coming up next with Michael Cathcart. As usual, a cracker.
A cracker, yes. Well, the Arts Minister, George Brandis, has sent a very powerful letter to the Australia Council telling it to come up with guidelines that will prevent a recurrence of what's been happening at the Biennale. So we'll have a chat about the implications of all that. And a great story from India, well, a disturbing story, where the government has just closed a play which tells the story of a Muslim boy. So that's one to cover.
Gosh, all right. That's coming up on Books and Arts Daily. And I'm looking forward to your company next on Life Matters. Stay with us. It's 10 a.m. on RN.